Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Welcome, everybody. This is our fourth out of 5 weeks that we'll be spending with hunting magic eels. So if you don't know where your eels are yet, your time is limited. And we are going to talk about Celtic enchantment practices this week. And so I'm going to read for you a Celtic enchantment from The Loves of Taliesin. And this is on pages 177 and 178 of your book if you are a visual listener. The beauty of berries at harvest time, beautiful too the grain on the stalk, the beauty of the sun clear in the sky, the beauty of a herd's thick-maned stallion, beautiful too the pattern of his plates, the beauty of desire and a silver ring, beautiful too a ring for a virgin, the beauty of an eagle on the shore when the tide is full, beautiful too the seagulls playing, beautiful too a generous and obliging minstrel, the beauty of May with its cuckoo and nightingale, beautiful too when good weather comes, the beauty of a proper and perfect wedding feast, beautiful too a gift which is loved, the beauty of desire for penance from a priest, beautiful too, bearing the elements to the altar. The beauty for a minstrel of mead at the head of the hall. The beauty of a faithful priest in his church. The beauty of the moon shining on the earth. Beautiful too, when your luck is good. The beauty of summer, its days long and slow. Beautiful too, visiting the ones we love. The beauty of flowers on the tops of fruit trees, beautiful too, covenant with the Creator. The beauty in the wilderness of doe and fawn, beautiful too, the foam-mouthed and slender steed. The beauty of the garden when the leeks grow well, beautiful too, the charlock in bloom. The beauty of the heather when it turns purple, beautiful too, pasture land for cattle. The beauty of the season when the calves suckle. And for me, there is no less beauty in the father of the horn in a feast of mead. The beauty of the fish in his bright lake. Beautiful too, its surface shimmering. The beauty of the word which the Trinity speaks. Beautiful too, doing penance for sin. But the loveliest of all is covenant with God on the day of judgment. There is a Celtic enchantment for you, this one from Wales. And just notice as we read that together how far different that is from like the bedtime prayers that we learned growing up.
It has an interesting lilt. And it kind of flows nature, and then it comes back to human beings, and then it flows to nature again, and then it comes back to the priest and being forgiven, and it flows out again. It's interesting how it wanders through all of that.
Yeah, the play of that poetry. So we will talk about poetry when we're talking about Celtic enchantments, and we will talk a lot about nature when we talk about those enchantments as well. So I want to start with talking about why it is that we need to work at enchantment. And what do we mean when we're talking about this premise that we have disenchanted our experience of the world? So throughout the book, Beck has been inviting us to focus on not just beliefs about God, right? We can have all the right beliefs and still not have had really an encounter with God, this experiential relationship with God. So when he's talking about encounters with God, not just beliefs, is he talking about the same thing? This is a rhetorical question. Is he talking about the same thing as a spiritual but not religious Christianity? Remember when we talked about the shift in how religion is playing out? One of the descriptors that people may use is spiritual but not religious. So Beck has been building this book on this narrative of enchantment 500 years ago to disenchantment, that process that we talked about with the way that the modern Christian church kind of killed God as someone that we experience. But there are reasons to doubt that story, that trajectory. And one of those reasons is that people may not call themselves religious these days, but a lot of people call themselves spiritual. They're going to hang on to that spiritual language, even if this religious language doesn't adequately describe their experience. Or now we've seen the shift in the public polling, you know, from spiritual but not religious to just none of the above. Don't describe me as any of these things. But he says, even the none of the above folks are still using like crystals and herbs and meditation and yoga. And so there are all of these spiritual practices, all of these enchantment looking things that are going on in this non-religious world, which could mean that enchantment isn't gone, but it has shifted. The focus of that enchantment may have shifted. So even disenchantment has not turned us into atheists. We're just sort of do-it-yourself spiritualists in the world today.
When you say religious, are we meaning that you're not particularly associated with a particular religion?
Not personally identifying with a particular religion.
Okay.
Whether or not you are involved in a religious community.
Okay.
You claim that religious label for yourself. And so the point is kind of regardless of whether you have some affiliation with a religious community or not, and especially if you don't, we are still enchanting the world in some ways, but we're enchanting the world differently. So these postmodern kinds of enchantments, you know, the crystals and the herbs and the meditation and the yoga. Now, meditation and yoga can be deeply rooted in religious traditions too, but this sort of do-it-yourself approach to enchantment, Beck is going to argue that these are a lot of them pointing us not beyond the world, but just at the world in ways that that are maybe a little bit lacking. So here's your first dose of history. This one's going to cover several centuries. So in the fourth century, the Roman Emperor Constantine converted the Roman Empire to Christianity. When you're the emperor, you can just say it, right? Now, Constantine had a religious experience. He had one of these eccentric experiences that we were talking about last week. He was preparing for battle at the Battle of Milvian Bridge in 313, and he had a vision. And Jesus showed him the sign of the chi and the rho that are the beginning of the word Christ in Greek, and said, "Now with this sign you will conquer." And Constantine was like, "Cool, I can do that." And so they painted this sign on all their shields, and they went off to battle, and they won, right? And that experience, that enchanted moment in Constantine's life led to his eventual conversion to Christianity. He was not a Christian at the time that happened. So he eventually converted to Christianity, and then he imposed Christianity on the entire empire over the course of a single emperor's reign. Now, the Roman Empire already had religious institutions, thank you very much. So there were these pagan institutions that were displaced by these Christian institutions that got sort of placed over top of them. But Beck is going to say that the culture of paganism, this cultural paganism, persisted. So, you know, we name our days of the week after the planets, right? We name our planets after pagan gods. We have, you know, our Christian religious festivals just very conveniently line up on top of pagan religious festivals. And up until the last few centuries, we have also very much believed in spirits and magic and all of these enchanted powers that have very close analogs in this pagan worldview. Now, a brief pause from the scholar of contemporary religions. Beck is using the word pagan as an adjective to describe Western culture. Whether that culture is nominally Christian or nominally secular, pagan, he's talking about sort of where your enchantments are pointed. There are also religious people who call themselves neo-pagans. So this is your Wiccans, your modern Druids. These are folks who want to recover paganism as a religion. And for these purposes, I'm going to set them aside tonight. That's not ultimately fair to them. But we're going to have a real Christian-centric discussion here. So when I use the word pagan here, I'm using it in the lowercase, like we did with charismatic and Pentecostal last week, as compared to capital P pagans who are over here, really bringing back a lot of these, the traditions that existed in parts of Europe, even really before the Romans got there. So, setting all of them aside, many of them are wonderful people. Here we are having a Christian-centric discussion. So enchantment is still here in this pagan kind of way. But the distinction Beck is going to make is that Christianity is looking for a transcendent enchantment. And paganism is looking at a very immanent enchantment. Immanent meaning completely present. So immanent is located within the world. Transcendent is located ultimately outside the world. So are we talking about the creation or are we talking about the creator? And again, this is one of those conversations that only makes sense within Christian theology. Now, the Old Testament and the New Testament, both as a matter of their cultural contexts, they assume that there exist in reality other gods, other spiritual powers alongside God. And so the question is not whether you believe or don't believe in these other spiritual powers alongside God, whether those are other gods, lowercase g, or whether they're just kind of fake and there's just one capital G God, but these other powers are powers. So the question is not whether you do believe in them. The question is that you must not worship them, right? First commandment, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me, right? Don't worship any of those other things. I'm not saying they're not there. In the New Testament, Paul, in Romans chapter 1, you can see it. In Acts chapter 14, you can see it. He recognizes that this created world reveals something to us about God, but it doesn't reveal everything about God. That's where these transcendent enchantments are going to take us, is to recognizing that what is revealed around us shows us something of God, but not everything of God. God is still beyond this created world. That's what we mean when we talk about a sacramental imagination. That's what sacrament is meaning. It's a sign that points beyond itself to God. And it is a gift of grace that indicates who is the giver, right? So, and you've got gifts like that probably at your house, right? That gift that, you know, you put it on the shelf because it, when you see it, you know, your grandma is there, or your brother-in-law is there, or your favorite student, you know you have one, is there. So that's what sacramental imagination is about, is looking at the world around us, seeing it as a gift, and knowing that that gift points us beyond itself to the giver, capital G, giver, who is God. So what's happening now is that that enchantment that had previously kind of pointed beyond itself to God, a lot of that enchantment is shifting back to this imminent only within the world kind of frame. So you see, for instance, the almost mystical power of a word like natural or organic, right? I have peppermint tea in my cup tonight from Celestial Seasonings, right? This is enchantment language, right?
Right.
And this is enchantment language about the amazing power of the natural world. And that's that shift from transcendent enchantment down to immanent enchantment. And that has good fruits and bad fruits. So the good thing about this, about these pagan enchantments that bring us back down into the present world, is that pagans are a lot more times more Christian than the Christians. Pagans, these pagan enchantments are about loving and affirming the natural world. Now, these pagans over here do that too, with religious language. Again, we're not talking about them. We're talking about this way of being in the world that we're looking for enchantment, and all we can find is this world. And that's great in that the natural world is to be loved. The natural world is very good, right? That's what God said. We believe that God is incarnate in this world. That's very good. That's amazingly good, right? So these pagan enchantments do have the effect of drawing us back down here into this world in which God chose to be incarnate. But it's also possible, particularly if you're not over here in a disciplined religious space, but you're here in sort of this sort of flat, wishy-washy kind of space that a lot of Christianity has landed in, and a lot of us have landed in whether we think we're being Christian or not, is that this immanent enchantment is something that we choose, right? Like, I feel like I want to do this. I'm going to purchase this. And so these enchantments have a really easy way of just being things, you know, kind of to our preferences. They never stand in judgment over us. They're always just things that I chose. I feel right. It'll be fine. Now, you can do that with transcendent enchantment too, but the invitation is to notice, what are those things that need to stand in judgment over us? So how do we allow these enchantments to push us outside of our comfort zone? How do we have them hold our feet to the fire for the ways that we live, for the ways that we love one another, the ways that we love God and this world? And so this story started at the well in Wales, where we were looking for the enchanted eels. And he said, okay, so the next day, then we went and, we went to the beach and the kids were swimming and that was lovely. And I was like, oh, this is great. And he thought, but there are a whole lot of people in the world who can't just go on vacation, right? It's really great to recognize God when you're on vacation. Vacation's a wonderful thing. You should all get to do it. But what if we could recognize where God is? What if we could be enchanted in the world, even in the boring and the difficult and the hard and the ugly things in life? What if we didn't have to go somewhere spectacular and just feel wonderful in order to recognize where God is? And what if our enchantments could weigh us on the scales, weigh us personally and our communities and our nation and our political party and find us wanting and point out the places where we are not yet the way that we are meant to be. How do we find enchantments that will actually call us to love sacrificially, to extend grace to the people that we would prefer not to extend grace to? The enchantments that would convict us of our sin so that we can repent and believe the good news. So that's what this shift back toward transcendent enchantment invites us to do. So here's your moment to chew and swallow, and then we will go to the Celtic lands. So notice what you heard that interested you. Notice any questions that have come up for you. You might want to jot those down so we can come back to them later when we have some discussion. So now we're going to talk about some Celtic enchantments, including that lovely poem that we read. But we're going to begin with some more history. So this is history that was a couple centuries after, about a century and a half, I guess, after Constantine met the vision of Christ at the Battle of Milvian Bridge. In the 5th century, there was a man named Patrick. And Patrick grew up in Britain. And at age 16, he was kidnapped into slavery in Ireland. And while he was tending sheep for the person who enslaved him, he was praying. And he was fasting. Sometimes he was fasting by choice, and sometimes he was fasting because he was starving. But he was on those hills of Ireland, not from Ireland, and praying. And the voice of God, after he was there for 6 years enslaved in Ireland, the voice of God told him when it was time for him to escape. And so he left the sheep behind and he made for the seashore and he got on a boat and he made it back to England. Whew! Until he became a priest and a bishop, and he felt that call to return as a missionary to the Celts. We'll talk about the Celts. This is not the Boston basketball team. They are pronounced differently. The Celts, loosely, were the ancestors of the Irish and the Welsh and the Scots. So Wales and Scotland are both on the Big Island of the British Isles. Ireland is largely located on the island of Ireland. And now the Romans had conquered much of Britain by 87 or so CE. So about, what is that, 34 years after Jesus died and, spoiler, was resurrected. And so the Romans conquered much of Britain. But really the part of Britain they conquered was south of what's called Hadrian's Wall, which Hadrian, the Roman military commander, built in order to keep the Celts on their side of the wall. Because he was scared of them and he couldn't conquer them. So Rome never conquered Scotland, never conquered Ireland. They sustained a military occupation in Wales, but they didn't have a lot of really cultural influence in Wales. The terrain is very different in Wales compared to the rest of the British Isles. So England was heavily, thoroughly Romanized. Southern Wales was fairly well Romanized. So that is to say that Roman culture was imposed by the empire upon the people. And so Roman ways of being, Roman place names, Roman sort of systems of putting your society together, those all happened in England and southern Wales, but not the Celts. the Celts, especially the ones in Ireland and Scotland, and to a lesser extent the ones in Wales, they stayed Celtic. So then Constantine, remember him, converted the empire to Christianity in the 4th century. Britain was already Roman. So everywhere before Constantine that Western Christianity had spread was already Roman. Now, when I say Western Christianity, I'm saying that so we don't forget that there's a whole Greek-Russian Cyrillic tradition. There's a Coptic Ethiopian tradition. There are Syriac traditions that kind of spread eastward. We're ignoring all of those because we are in Britain right now. So Patrick from Britain went back to Ireland with the gospel, and he went for the first time Christian missionary on non-Roman soil. So he took this religion that had grown up entirely on Roman soil and took it somewhere that didn't have these Roman cultural assumptions to hold it together. And so the religion took on the flavor of this new place. You can see actually similar dynamics when Roman-shaped Christianity encountered indigenous cultures in the Americas, in China, in Korea, in India. So there are other places this same dynamic has happened. But here we are in Ireland, and Patrick manages to convert people, manages to plant the Christian faith in Ireland. And for the next 500 years, Irish monks would bring Christianity back across to Scotland. So Scottish Christianity comes from Ireland, not from the south in England. They would also, these Irish monks would take Celtic Christianity to the rest of Europe until the Vikings invaded Ireland and they had to quit. So this is another flavor of Christianity, and it has its unique ways of being enchanted. Now, we've been self-critical so far. We're going to be self-critical again. There are problems with Celtic Christianity. You saw me do the thing with my fingers. And one of the problems with Celtic Christianity is actually similar to the problem that we identified with these pagan enchantments, and that is commercialization. That, man, Celtic is a great brand, right? And you can invent some funky mumbo jumbo and brand it with like a fancy knot or a little poetic blessing, and you can sell that as Celtic TM, right? But Beck will be sure, as he's talking about Celtic enchantments, he will only use historical Celtic sources. So be aware that not everything that passes itself off as Celtic is authentically Celtic, but what we will say tonight is 100% authentic. But there are also historical issues here. So it's not 100% clear that the Celts were ever like a unified culture group. And there was definitely a lot of interplay between the Roman and Celtic cultures, right? Like you don't build a stone wall all the way across an island to keep people out because they're not interfacing with your culture. So there's that. But there is this unique flavor to the Christianity that grew in Celtic soil. So here are some tasting notes for you when we talk about Celtic Christianity. You're going to find a real affinity for place and for nature. So pre-Christian, that is pre-Roman, right? Pre-Christian Celtic rituals, they were all rooted in these sacred places. These standing stones that are set up as spiritual sites. The most famous is Stonehenge, but there are plenty more. These are these thin spaces where the boundary between the spiritual world and the physical world is so thin you can see through it. And so Celtic Christians would carry pieces of that into being Christian. And so they would set up these high crosses. They would identify these holy wells. Almost every village has a holy well. And you find that these geographic places are enchanted. So it's not just the sanctuary of a church that's enchanted, right? But You might have to build a church there because the place is already enchanted. And by enchanting specific places, what you're doing is you're noticing that every place gives us access to the grace and the beauty of God. So it's not like only the well with the magic eels is enchanted, but everything's enchanted you can see because of the well with the magic eel. So that's one of those distinctive notes. Another distinctive note is poetry. So in these Celtic traditions, poetry has this really unique power to connect to spiritual realities, to communicate spiritual realities. So when you read and write poetry, you're not just having fun with language, you're not just wooing a lover, you're actually plugging into this sacramental imagination that sees through reality to God. And there is this this feminine power that is at work in Celtic spiritualities. So you heard a little bit in the poem that we read at the beginning, these pairs of opposites. And so sacred opposites are a piece of this this approach to enchantment. So, you know, opposites like hot and cold and sun and moon. And there's this particular attention, especially with those sacred opposites, to this sacred feminine. Now, you see similar attention to the sacred feminine in traditions that honor Mary, the Mother of God, who call her the Mother of God. We don't even do that as Presbyterians, right? Like, it's Mary, the Mother of Jesus, who happens to be God, but that's not her job, right? And we're like really careful about that. Like, I just had to catch myself so I could stay Presbyterian. But there is this practice of remembering that God is nurturing and mothering. And that's actually this really particular eccentric mode of enchantment. Because if we depend on God to nurture and mother us, and not just to be the father that we have to prove ourselves to, right? But no, like, we can depend on God. And dependency on God, that is eccentric. That's that depending outside of ourselves. So this may sound still kind of pagan to you, but the content of this enchantment is not just baptized paganism. This is a really recognizably Christian in content. In some of these unique forms, but like the poetry is really clear. Creation is a gift from God. It's not God itself. And so we had all of this beauty and all of this beauty and all of this beauty, but when God was referred to as an entity in God's self, that that the creation is pointing us to God. The creation is not itself God. So Christ is the one who comes to us in the rain and the sun and the wind. And we receive nature as a gift. We use nature to pray to God, but it is always God to whom we are praying. Celtic Christianity, this is part of how you can tell if you are buying the real thing or not. Celtic Christianity is not just sentimental. Celtic Christianity has a very high place for discipline. They call these spiritual disciplines, they call them the green martyrdom. There presumably is another color of martyrdom where you actually get killed, but these disciplines are themselves a kind of martyrdom. So fasting and penitence and you know, this beauty of nature, but these are harsh natural settings. And if you've been to these beautiful places, you have seen how harsh they are. Imagine living there, you know, much more exposed than we are in this modern world that we live in. And these disciplines and these practices are not because our bodies are bad, right? Not because we have to overcome our body, but rather because we want to embody these spiritual practices, actually bring those practices inside us. So when we set a pleasure aside as part of fasting, we actually do then enjoy it all the more when the time comes. So you're not just cutting something out, you're actually using that give and take, right? This is another sacred opposite. You're using that as discipline. So fasting and feasting go together. And there is sort of the flip side of this very embodied disciplined spirituality. There are these prayers called breastplate prayers, like breastplate, like armor. They are prayers that bind on God's protection, like you are putting your armor on, because the world is full of these malign spiritual powers, right? So the world is a dangerous spiritual place to be. And we are vulnerable to the world. We are porous to the world outside of us. And so what we need is God's protection as we live in that world, not to be buffered by like holding the world out at arm's length and only seeing it through a Zoom box, but to really know that we are vulnerable to the world and we depend on God to protect us in it. And that's what these breastplate prayers are like. This Celtic approach also has a really high value for companionship. So they have the tradition of the soul friend, who is someone who really bears Christ's presence to you. They bring Christ's presence to you because this spiritual life is eccentric. Christ is out there, not just inside me, which is not to say Christ is not also inside me, right? But I'm always looking beyond myself. And again, this does not depend on everybody getting on their plane and flying over to Ireland or Wales or Scotland, which are marvelous places to go, but is really easy to experience enchantment when you're there on vacation, right? Anybody can feel a little bit Celtic when you're in Ireland or Wales. But really the point of these enchantments is to enchant the place where you are, enchant the place where you find yourself, wherever you happen to live. And so the prayer is, Lord of all places, how good you are to praise. So chew and swallow again, catch your breath, notice what came up that interested you, notice what questions may have risen up for you.
Well, one of my favorite shows on television.
Give us a moment so we all have a chance to process.
I process fast.
Okay, go on ahead.
One of my favorite shows is Outlander. And it's interesting that the main character, the female character, comes from the present, goes through these stones into Celtic Scotland. And she is a healer. When she goes back to the real world, she's a surgeon. And it's just interesting how they show the change between her being in the modern world, goes through this transition and goes into Scotland. And it does a good job bringing up all the differences of culture in Scotland. That's what it made me think of.
And I think there's a case to be made that science fiction is a mode of enchantment. Whether it is Christian enchantment or not depends on the content of the science fiction. And in my experience, much of Christian fiction is terrible. But on the other hand, the Lord of the Rings trilogy is explicitly a Christian allegory, not explicitly. So it doesn't tell you it's a Christian allegory, but once you find out that that's the case, it's everywhere. So there is good Christian fiction, and that's not the only one. But yeah, there's something that trip sort of across, you know, through the thin place into the other realm. Yeah, Deb.
I don't think Outlander is Christian.
I wasn't saying it was.
Yeah, they don't pretend to be.
Deb. It has connections and a lot of history in it that's accurate. I was thinking of Anne Rice books, The Witching Hour and Lasher and The Mayfair Witches. And she's got a lot of history that's history. And you see connections. Interesting, she was considered herself an atheist after writing all these books with vampires and witches and different demons. She has written a couple books on Christianity that are pretty good to read. So interesting. She came full circle. She is now a practicing Catholic.
I had forgotten that. Yeah, I have only read her atheist books. So I haven't read her Christian books. Yeah, so there is this, you know, and that's, you know, that's prose rather than poetry, but maybe a similar, you know, a similar thing to this dynamic in these Celtic poems, mm-hmm. that are using language as a way of kind of mediating these spiritual truths. Bev, unmute yourself and go ahead.
Thanks for that reminder. As you were talking, I kept thinking of the Celts as being a softer culture, more tuned in, more empathetic, perhaps, sensitive. And as you say, even their soul friend. I mean, there's so many things that are showing warmth. Bruce and I have been over there twice and absolutely love all that it is. And do you think that might have, because of the lack of Romans taking over, and Romans, you know, they were a little tougher, I kind of think of them not as the softer side.
I think there's something to that. Yeah. So a lot of, you know, a lot of sort of the some of the toxic strains of what we think of as masculinity. Right. You can see pieces of that tracing sort of back down through the, you know, even to the way that that Paul, who is a Romanized Jew,
right.
talks about gender roles in his letters. And he's usually fairly good about, when he's talking about gender roles, he's usually pretty good about acknowledging that he's speaking for himself and not specifically for God. He oversteps in a couple of places, I think, but you can see some of the, you know, some of those sort of, I must be strong and tough and masculine, even all that far back, which is not to say that the particular ways in which the men on this screen have our own unique pressures to be masculine as, and specifically as contrary to femininity, right?
Right.
And Roman culture, particularly kind of among the elites, the sort of propertied people, was kind of dog eat dog. You know, and some of that was, you know, in just, you know, we ignore all the women until it's time for them to do something for us. So when we talk about culture, we're only talking about men anyway. But the ways that people were sort of structured into this hierarchy of dependency and there's competition for who gets to move to the next rank, right? Part of probably what happened with Celtic society, it's not like there weren't hierarchies, but you had probably a more local society. And more local societies tend to be more egalitarian.
And so what is that? What's egalitarian?
Egalitarian. People are more kind of on the same level with each other.
Like equalitarian.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I see, rather than carrying shields, they're helping each other with farming. They're helping building stone walls, one stone at a time, and then they take them apart when they let the sheep out. I mean, there's so many things that is more the music. I mean, music, somebody walks in with a guitar, somebody walks in with spoons, somebody walks in with a little harp or whatever and a violin, and boy, they're at it. And it is all stories of the region. I just think it's just a warmer.
Yeah.
At the same time,
you've got a really fierce martial tradition. It's Hadrian didn't fail to conquer Scotland because he was too hard and they were too soft, right?
Yeah.
Hadrian failed to conquer Scotland because the Scots fought back.
Okay.
Because they were being
attacked, they had to protect themselves. They had that knowledge. They didn't need to use it. I mean, amongst themselves so much. But they do.
There was some of that too.
Yeah.
There's something to be said about clans, because within clans, there are certain cultures that were not necessarily all of Scotland, but within the clans, they had cultures. But then there's a hierarchy among the clans when it comes time to fight. You know, you get your whatever you fought with in Scotland. You joined together and you were against a common enemy. They did fight against each other, and the Campbells were known for being a pain. There are bars in Scotland that say no Campbells allowed, for a good reason.
No colors.
It's what?
No colors.
You can't.
You can't wear your soccer thing. It's a right. Fight. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so, There's probably a piece too of this, you know, these sacred opposites at play, that being warm and tender and caring is not necessarily exclusive with being able to be hard and fierce and violent, even in a world in which violence has been fairly common among people for all of human history, but the idea that there is only one good way to be, that's probably one of those Roman pagan practices that we have, you know, carried along with us, as compared to, there's sort of a give and take to life. And I don't say that to try to excuse the violence that certainly has been present within these Celtic traditions. But it may be that when we try to say this is all one thing or this is all one other thing, we may be viewing it through a lens that's actually foreign to what we're talking about, which is this give and take, right? Yeah. So this, you know, we have the, the faithful priest in the church, and we've got the minstrel singing for his mead, right? And we've got the the need for penitence and the need for feasting, and we've got the animals and the hunters, and you know, so there's it's not that one of those things is good and the other one of those things is not good, but it is that they, even though on the surface they're in conflict with each other, they may both be good.
Interesting.
Bruce.
I read a book recently that talks about some genius who figures out that all religions are against one another, competition for who's in power.
It's all about money.
And this book goes on to say that he was going to debunk some of the religions, and many different religions had people out to hunt him down and kill him because it's against their thinking, okay? But there's thousands of viewpoints on God. You look at South America, you look at the Mayans, the Aztecs, who's up in the mountains there? Machu Picchu, Incas. You look at in Ireland, you look at, go back to the Greeks, the Romans, all the gods that they created. And it was whoever could get the power to get people to believe in these idols or these gods or whatever, has the power. And that it's just crazy. And then I think about John Lennon's song, Imagine all the people with no boundaries, no religions too. Mm-hmm. How much peaceful the world would be without borders, boundaries, religions, differences of opinion, blacks, whites. I mean, it's just like, it's crazy.
So yeah, there's that sort of request for, you know, what if these things didn't have to be mutually exclusive? Without setting aside the beauty of, you know, distinct cultures or distinct ways of being in the world, which again, I kept my poem open here, right? And so we've got, you know, there's specific beauty in, you know, the gifts of May. I almost delayed reading this for a week so that we could have it during May. But the birds that come in May as compared to, you know, the grain that you don't see until later in the year, and they each have their beauty. And it's not like you don't have to choose, right? Now, sometimes you have to choose between birds and grain because the birds will make that choice for you. But what if we didn't have the world sort of boxed off into these little segments and took time like the poets do to see, or like the songwriters and the Beatles do, to what if, you know, what if this world was different? That's actually a Celtic, they're not the only people with poetry, but that's a Celtic mode of enchantment.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. John. From England.
In this last week, I have run across three different things that made me think about the enchantment stuff, but I am more confused than ever. But I'll tell you what those three things are, and maybe you can tell me what I ought to be thinking. One is that I read that Abraham Maslow, who will be familiar to some of you, as the guy who was a prominent psychologist, I'm going to say 100 years ago, and created the hierarchy of, not values.
Needs.
Needs, okay, needs, thank you. And how he had it all backwards, because somebody compared that, and apparently his stay with the Ute Indians, and I can't even tell you where I saw the article, probably online, that's where weird stuff happens. But he was talking about how the Utes' needs are exactly backwards from ours. And that resounded in what Bruce was saying about why why can't we all get along? Now, the Utes, above all else, value their culture. So said this. I'm not an expert, to say the least. And at the other end of the hierarchy of needs was things. So the somewhere in there, I think there's room for enchantment. I'm not sure what it meant, but that's what struck me. Another thing, I have been reading off and on a book in which there are djinn, D-J-I-N-N, and again, a couple of you may know what that is. I didn't until fairly recently. They are apparently spirits that live in the Arab world who inhabit and enchant things and spaces and times and are not necessarily malevolent. They're more impish, as I, from what I get. But if your version of their impishness is malevolent, that's the way you're going to see them. And then we get to traditional Christianity. None of us thinks very often about exorcisms and demons, but Jesus very much believed in them. The Bible, particularly the Gospels, talked about them explicitly and directly, and we have gotten away from thinking about them at all. I don't know what demons were. I don't get the feeling that they were necessarily extensions of the devil, but nobody agrees on what the devil was either. Nevertheless, whatever enchantment value they had, we've gotten away from completely. Maybe we can say we are enchanted enough to not have to think about them, that that's an enchantment by itself. But those are three things that have come to mind and have left me completely confused. And now you all have the rest of the week to talk about this. I'm going to watch the Cubs.
That's terrific. Okay, so I also saw links to the article about Maslow stole the hierarchy of needs and did it poorly. That's as far as I got. I didn't click through to it either. But it does remind us, whether that article in particular is founded or not, we do notice that the things that we think are universal, the values that we hold, and even the needs that we think we have are very much culturally bound.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the things that you're absolutely certain that you can't live without. Now, some may be things that you will physiologically pass away for lack of, right? We know that. But we also know that the choices that we make, the amount of time that Americans spend at work because of the value that we get from doing work for very long periods of time, as compared to the value that we evidently place on time with our families. And it's not to say that, it's not to say that there's necessarily even a singular good or bad to that, right? But this, I have to go to work to provide for my family is not how, for instance, work is viewed in several other cultures of the world. And you can see that play out in part by we spend a lot more time at work, whether that has to do with we're trying to keep up with a higher standard of living, or we have these cultural forces that change the way that we picture ourselves as people, or maybe we really are just better at this and we really know how much people should work and everybody else has to catch up.
And that was particularly true of the Utes, according to the article.
Okay.
That they have that need reversed from us.
Okay. And so again, not being able to check the sources on the article, it is definitely the case that this white American culture in which we live leads us to spend much more time working than, I think, than any other country in the world. I'm pretty sure we work more hours than the Japanese, which is saying something. So,
and yet there are countries who value vacation time. And so they say, you must take a vacation, you know, a week, 2 weeks, but as your employment, you must take a vacation, which we think is great if it's included, but it's not something anybody says, you must take a week off. We're afraid we'll lose our job.
Right. And so I will set to the side, set that over here with the neo-pagans, the question of whether we ought to view work in the way that we do. But it is a fact that we act differently around work than people in other cultures do. We draw those balances between those otherwise both perfectly good needs, right? We need to provide for our family. We need to spend time with our family. And we draw that balance very differently than many other cultures in the world, which is an illustration of the way that these values and even understood needs are actually cultural practices. And when we talk about these different modes of enchantment, and particularly tonight, because we're talking about a mode that is bound into this specific culture, and you know, we're drinking from the magic eel-filled well of this culture, when we look at that, we are allowing ourselves to notice that it doesn't have to be the way that we thought it was. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be the way that we grew up with it being.
It'll be interesting to see what the pandemic and staying at home and working at home, how that's changed some folks' imagining of what work should be like. You know, that could be an interesting conversation as we start to get back to work and people say, I don't know that I want to work in an office building for 8 hours a day. I kind of liked being home some with my family. You know, it'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Just if I might interject real quickly, Marcy, and not only because of, like you say, the pandemic happened 10 years ago, my CEO was saying, young people, graduates, postgraduates are coming in and saying, I'm starting out at 6 weeks vacation. Mm-hmm. And that is so coincides with that generation that is not coming to a brick and mortar church.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is something that is happening more and more, is that they are demanding more time. And so they learned they don't want to have their families perhaps grow up as we did. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things that all of a sudden, like John, I'm like, oh, this is confusing, because it does come together. I mean, it all makes sense.
Yeah, good observation.
Yeah, so this is, on the one hand, this is this unique, weird year, and this year is still in the thick of it in much of the world, right? We are a lot closer to the end of the active stage of the pandemic in the United States than in a lot of the world. Mm-hmm. But so this year raised all of these questions. But as Bev says, there's a whole generation's been asking these questions the whole time they've been in the workforce. Mm-hmm. And have been saying, this is not the only way it has to be. Another piece that the pandemic has done that maybe will sit right in this Celtic enchantment is people who used to travel didn't travel this year. Right? You know, Warren Pitcher has been inside the country since the beginning of March last year.
Oh my goodness.
It's terrifying, isn't it? And so people are, you know, that we started with this language of like, I'm going to go on a vacation to the backyard, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But what are we saying when we say I'm going on vacation to the backyard? Mm-hmm. We're saying I'm going to take my vacation eyes and see what the yard looks like, you know, see what this place looks like when I look at it with these enchanted eyes, right? Because that's the eyes you take on vacation.
Yeah.
You leave your work eyes at home, you know, and if you've ever taken your work with you on a vacation, you know how hard that is, right? Because you've got your work eyes on and it doesn't matter where you are, right? Because you've got your work eyes and everything's flat.
Yeah.
Right? You take your vacation eyes, your enchanted eyes, and this backyard has like birds in it. Did you realize that?
We've got dandelions.
We do.
Yeah. You know, and the pollinators really love the dandelions because they are some of the earliest flowers out. Thank God for dandelions and the stupid European person who brought dandelions over as a crop.
Yeah. What about the djinn and the demons? Anything to say there other than, I mean, can you help unconfuse me?
So there are most definitely demons all through the New Testament. You are right about that. And they are probably generally speaking closer to djinn than the way that we think about demons, which, you know, we think about demons as little horns and pitchforks and they're all bad, right? But they're just some of these complicated landscape of spiritual beings in the world. So you have this, you know, it's a much more populated supernatural realm than we deal with most of the time, which is why I pointed the piece out about the Bible, that the Bible has, from the word go, assumed that there are other gods. And it only quit assuming that the other gods were really real toward the late, late books in the Old Testament. Most of the New Testament assumes that the other gods are not really gods. They're just, you know, they're some other spiritual being that's just messing with our heads. But the actual, are there other beings that are operating outside of God's authorization? There are also other beings that are operating under God's authorization, right? So, you know, we sort of separate angels, which are the good ones, from demons, which are the bad ones. That's kind of a New Testament distinction that doesn't even completely hold in the New Testament. In the Arabic imagining of jinn, which is a this is within an Islamic context anyway. I'd have to learn a little bit more before I could confidently say it's either from Islamic sources or not. But this idea that jinn are more sort of, they're more ambivalent, right? Sometimes they're doing good things, sometimes they're doing bad things. I mean, this sounds a lot like what? Like leprechauns?
Okay.
And or gnomes? Genies. And like, what's that?
Genies.
And genies. Oh, Bev, you muted yourself and then started talking.
Thank you. Leprechauns you can see, supposedly. I mean, with enough beer. But I think that, sorry, but the Oxford Dictionary is the definition of jinn is a certain type of spirit in Islam, you were right, similar to an angel. The word jinn, D-G-I-N-N, comes from the Arabic J-I-N-N, which a plural noun that means both demons and spirits, and also literally hidden from sight. So you can't see them.
I will also tell you that there is a world that few of us experience that exists between midnight and 5 a.m. on AM radio. It is populated by two kinds of beings. One is right-wing fire breathers. The other is talk show hosts who regularly have on people who see or don't see aliens and any manner of ghosts or anything you could name. And I, since I've never seen any of those things, I'm a bit jealous, but I wonder what they either know or don't know about the enchanted world, because I can't seem to visit there.
Well, and it seems like from our scientific mindset, when we read the Bible and we look at spirits, we try to define it as some kind of a medical condition that this person had and Christ healed them. Instead of it's, you know, it's a malevolent spirit. And because we're just, at least we Presbyterians are not very much into Satan. You know, I tend to talk about the powers of evil because I believe there are powers of evil. But I refuse to call it Satan, even though the Bible calls it Satan. But as modernists, we try to look at a passage and think, well, what's physically wrong with that person that they didn't understand in that ancient time? And sometimes that's true, and sometimes it's not. It's just an evil spirit or whatever.
And going back to this slow death of God chapter, Beck would point out that that modernist orientation is part of how we have, almost like we were trying to, quit experiencing God.
Yeah.
Because when we ask a question like, okay, the Bible says so-and-so had an unclean spirit and Jesus cast the unclean spirit out and that then they were better. When we ask the question, what was that really?
Yeah.
You know, was that really a, you know, a physical malady that this person had? Was that really a neurological disorder that that person had? What we're saying, that the implication in asking that question is that physical stuff is more real than the spiritual realities that that story points to. That physical stuff is more real. If it's really just epilepsy, then there's no more spiritual content to this story.
And
so if we frame the question that way, and we look for a real reality underneath this spiritual sounding text, we are practicing disenchantment. Go ahead.
If I go to, I will say Ireland, but it could be Wales, Scotland, and probably 100 other places. But those are the only ones I have any familiarity with. Every tree stump and teapot is enchanted. And they're quite happy with that. And they get along with it just fine. And I'm a little jealous of that too.
Yeah, so every little thing is enchanted. And so every little thing is identified as this sort of gateway to the future, or to the spiritual world, to this other realm, right? And so every little spot has had that attention poured into it.
And if I see, or at least I'm aware of, the spirit in that tree stump or teapot, I am paying attention.
Yeah.
That's the way I think you're saying it.
Yeah. When this, several weeks ago, when Chaplain Ruby was on with us, talking about hospice chaplaincy and the stuff that's important to us in the process of dying, and the stuff when we get to that process that we remember was important to us, but we acknowledged that there's something in that moment of being with someone as they die that is revelatory, right? That opens us up to notice God. And we sort of, you know, sort of fumbled around like, and I certainly fumbled around like, I can't tell you what that is, right? So as we've been working on this, on talking about enchantment, I would say that that moment is an enchanted moment. And the way it is enchanted is because when you're in that room, you are paying attention. Mm-hmm. Right? You are really actually paying attention to this beloved person and, you know, their life and the lives that are around you, but you're just paying attention, right? Which is how every, you know, every tree stump and hole in the ground gets to be enchanted, is by paying attention to them. So I would say, just as a, I'm so Western and skeptical, I need to categorize everything. So as a matter of categorization, under our modern framework in which everything fits cleanly in a category, I would say that enchantment of being with someone as they pass away is actually a contemplative enchantment. It's that mode of attention, right? Because you're just present, right? But by, you know, blessing and enchanting and giving thanks for and being with all this physical stuff around us, that's also that same kind of pouring that attention into that place, right? Physical, geographical place. And that's what these Celtic enchantments are about. So maybe when you are, you know, maybe when you're out weeding the garden, because, you know, we had some good weed growing weather today. You know, when you're out weeding the garden, you know, maybe there's, you know, maybe there's a blessing in that, right? Maybe, you know, maybe you are pouring some of that sacred attention into that place and that dirt that you have tended for however many years you've tended that piece of dirt. Or the, you know, the places that you go, you know, maybe there is noticing the attention that has already been poured into recognizing God's presence, you know, and allow that to invite you to notice, oh, this is a gift. And this is a gift from, right? Like, and that's not a proof of God, right? That's a practice of God. You know, this, oh, you know, the beautiful, you know, the beautiful warm sun today that, you know, we got to feel and really experience, you know, that's a gift. And I'm not going to say that, you know, the presence of sunlight necessarily logically implies the presence of God, but the presence of sunlight can most definitely point me to the presence of God. So that's what these enchantments are about.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.